He watches his life play out on the screen of the blank ceiling, or sometimes in the light playing on his window. He cannot control the content or order of the reels. What he can do is observe dispassionately, separate emotions from event, and judge the actor who plays him. An early winter storm comes over Ocean City and reaches inland by afternoon, first with freezing rain crackling on the window, and then snow so heavy that when he stands outside, it weighs down his eyelashes. It blankets northern New Jersey 5 to 6 inches in as many hours. It shuts down interstates, airports, schools, and all commerce, but he knows nothing of this as he retreats to his room. Ice forms around the edges of his window, leaving a narrow prism through which to look onto a still and ghostly world. It is on this evening that he witnesses a scene from his life which makes him want to end it. He is seated on his bed, staring through that narrow breach in the frosted window. His mind is motionless and hushed like the landscape outside. The only thing that stirs is the ebb and flow of his breath, but even that seems to cease. Then, suddenly, he feels a quickening, as if the wearing away of brain cells has unroofed a lacuna of memory. What spews out that winter's night is a vivid, colorful, and specific memory of Sister Mary Joseph Praise. He is simply the observer, a man watching a bird, unaware of the feral cat lurking in the wisteria. This is what he sees, what he remembers. Addis Ababa. Missing hospital. Work. He sees himself in the rhythm of operating, of clinics, of writing, forcing himself to sleep, his days full and satisfying. The weeks and months roll by. The master word. Work. And suddenly the machinery ceases. He thinks of this as his missing period. He prefers that to breakdown. It always begins the same way. He wakes from sleep in his quarters at missing, wakes in terror, unable to breathe, as if he is about to die, as if the next breath will trigger the explosion. Though he is awake, the tentacles of dream and nightmare won't let go. A terrifying spatial distortion is the hallmark of this state. His bedroom in his quarters begins to shrink. His pen, the doorknob, his pillow, ordinary objects that normally do not merit a second glance, balloon in size. They become colossal and threaten to impale him, to suffocate him. He has no control over this state. He cannot turn it off by sitting up or moving around. He becomes neither child nor man, does not know where he is or what scene he is reliving, but he is terrified. Alcohol is not the antidote. It does not break the spell, yet it dulls the terror. It comes with a price. Instead of straddling the line between wakefulness and nightmare, he crosses over. He roams in a world of familiar objects turned into symbols. He traipses through scenes of his childhood and through hell's portals. He hears a non-stop dialogue like cricket commentary on the radio. That is the backdrop to these night terrors in Ethiopia. The commentator's voice is indistinct. Sometimes it sounds like his own voice. As he drinks, he loses his fear, but not his sorrow. He who has no tears in his waking now weeps like a child. He sees Ghosh, probably the real Ghosh, not a dream figure, standing before him, concerned, the Ghosh lips moving, but the words drowned out by the commentator. Then she is there. He cannot hear her words, but her presence is reassuring, and ultimately, only she stays. Only she keeps vigil. She must have been asleep when she was summoned, because she wears a headscarf and a dressing gown. She holds him to her when a new wave of tears appears, and she cries with him, trying to rescue him from his nightmare, but in the process, she gets sucked in. Every time he recalls this, there is a stirring in him. In their work together, they share an intimacy that involves the body of another who lays between them, unconscious, naked, and exposed. But this weeping in her arms is shockingly different from their gowned forearms brushing or heads bumping during surgery. Separated as they are by an operating table for so many hours a day, when she holds him, the absence of the table, or of the mask, or the gloves, is startling. He feels like a newborn placed against its mother's naked belly. She whispers in his ear. What does she say? How he wishes he could remember. It sounds improvised, not a formal prayer. It succeeds in blunting the commentator's voice. He remembers her blouse, damp with his tears. No, both their tears. He remembers clinging to her, pressing his face to her bosom, sleeping, waking, clinging, weeping, sleeping again. She asks again and again, "What is it? What is it that has come over you?" For hours, days, who knows how long, she stays with him as he holds on for dear life, the storm raging, battering him, trying to pry him out of her grasp. He remembers a lull, a startling silence which is a change in the pattern. Her blouse has opened. Like a surgeon working to develop a tissue plane under the incision, he wills the blouse to open farther, and perhaps his nose, his cheeks, help it along. Her nipples stir from the coins on which they lie, and now her breasts escape her blouse to meet his lips. Her face must be a mirror of his, because what he sees in it is fear coupled with desire. She hovers over him, naked, her breasts full and reassuring, tears of relief on both their faces, their kisses devouring each other to make up for time lost. Then he is above her, and she looks up at him as if he is the savior. When he enters her, he is anchoring himself to her goodness, a goodness and innocence he lost so young, from which he has drifted away and which he vows never to let go. Sitting on his bed in his New Jersey exile, the world outside muted in a canopy of snow, his heart is racing, a dangerous tachycardia, his shirt soaked with sweat despite the cold. There is a dull ache under his breastbone. How he wishes that he could recall the exact feel of her lips, of her breasts. But he recalls this, and he prays it is a true image. He recalls how he loses himself in her, pulling her like a soft lamb coat over him. She settles on him, smothers him like a nightfall over a meadow. In their coming together, they thwart the demons, his and hers. And when his cry of release comes, it punctuates her soft exclamations. Order is restored. Proportion returns. Sleep comes as a blessing. His curse is this, and he weeps in New Jersey at the recollection. He beats his head with his hand. When he wakes up from his missing period, he senses only a perturbation in space, a gap in time, a deep embarrassment and shame, the reason for which he cannot recall, but which he can only heal by throwing himself into his work anew. He has blocked out what came before. How cruel it is that this memory should surface in a winter storm so long after she is dead. How cruel to have this fleeting, fragmented vision seen through an ice-crusted window than to wonder if it is real or if it is the perturbation of a brain undone by alcohol. He has reassembled the memory like a shattered relic, and it is finally whole. And still he has doubts. He will never see her more clearly than that night at 529 Maple. When he recalls it in later years, he will wonder if he is distorting it, embellishing it, because each time he consciously recalls her, that forms a new memory, a new imprint to be stacked on top of the previous one. He fears that too much handling will make it crumble. You saved my life. he says aloud to Sister Mary Joseph Prays, seated on his small bed in New Jersey. And my stupidity, my indecision, my panic caused you to lose yours. Though it is much too late to say it to her, he knows it must be said, and though he is a non-believer, he hopes that somehow she is listening. I cannot love any human being more than I love you. What he cannot bring himself to mention is the children. He feels he can do even less for them than he can do for Sister Mary Joseph Prays. They exist. Two boys. Twins. He knows. He remembers. In a universe even more removed than the one in which Sister resides. But it is too late to say all this to Sister Mary Joseph Prays. Even this memory of her, beautiful and erotic, cannot arouse him or fill him with joy. Instead, when he sees her nakedness, his engorgement, the miscibility of their parts, what he feels is a violent jealousy, as if another person occupies his naked body and straddles the woman he loves, an illusion de soi's. That is me, but it is not me. His thrusting body, the dark triangles of his shoulder blades, the hollows and dimples of the low back, only foretell death and destruction. They are an augury to a terrible end, because this carnal pleasure will doom Mary, though she does not know it as yet. But he, watching the scene, does. His punishment is even worse. He must live. Chapter 47. Missing Letters. Thomas Stone stayed in my room past midnight. At some point, he became one with the dark shadows, his voice filling my space as if no other words had ever been spoken there. I didn't interrupt him. I forgot he was there. I was inhabiting his story, lighting a candle in St. Mary's Church in Fort St. George, Madras, holding my own in an English boarding school, seeing how an unroofing of memory might lead to a vision of Mary. And if visions could happen in Fatima and Lourdes and Guadalupe, who was I to doubt that the secular vision of my mother had not appeared to him in a frost-rimmed rooming-house window, just as I had seen and felt her in the autoclave room as a young boy? His voice walked me into a past that preceded my birth. But it was still mine, as much as the color of my eyes or the length of my index finger. I became conscious of Thomas Stone only when he was done. I saw a man under the spell of his own tail, a snake charmer whose serpent has become his turban. The silence afterward was terrible. Thomas Stone saved our surgery program. He did it by making Our Lady of Perpetual Succor an affiliate of Mecca in Boston. All it took was his affixing his signature to a letter saying it was so. But Our Lady of Perpetual Succor was no mere paper affiliate of Mecca. Each month, four medical students and two surgical residents came down from Mecca to do a rotation with us. A safari to see the natives killing each other and to catch a few Broadway shows, is how B.C. Gandhi put it when he heard about the plan. But each of us also had opportunities to do specialty rotations up in Boston. I finished my internship and began my second year of residency. The most important result of our affiliation with Mecca was that it allowed Deepak, the wandering Jew of surgery, as B.C. referred to him, to finish. He was now a board-certified surgeon and could have gone anywhere to set up practice. Instead, he stayed on at Our Lady with the title of Director of Surgical Training. He was also appointed Clinical Assistant Professor at Mecca. I had never seen Deepak happier. Thomas Stone, true to his word, paved the way for publication of Deepak's study on injuries to the vena cava. That paper in the American Journal of Surgery became a classic, one that everyone quoted when discussing liver injuries. Though Deepak was getting a consultant salary, he continued to live in the house staff quarters. Courtesy of the Mecca surgical residents who came down to the Bronx for rotations, we had more manpower and Deepak got more sleep. In an unused basement space, Deepak researched the effects of different interruptions to the blood supply of pig and cow livers. Popsy's dementia no longer needed to be concealed. He roamed safely throughout Our Lady, wearing scrubs and with a mask dangling from his neck. He was turned away every time he wandered into the operating room or tried to leave the premises, but he didn't seem to mind. He would sometimes stop people and declare, "I contaminated myself!" Late on Friday evening, a few months after Thomas Stone's first visit to my room, I heard a knock at my door. There he stood, tentative, embarrassed, and unsure what his reception would be. My father's long confessional had changed things for me. It had been much easier to stay angry with him, to trash his apartment and violate his space before I heard his story. Now his presence felt awkward, and I didn't invite him in.
"I can't stay, but I want to ask if... would you care to join me for dinner at an Ethiopian restaurant in Manhattan tomorrow? Saturday? Here's the address. About 7?
This was the last thing I expected from him. If he'd invited me to go to the Met or to dine at the Waldorf Astoria, I would have declined without any hesitation. But when he said Ethiopian restaurant, it conjured up the sour taste of injera and the fiery wat, and my mouth began watering and my tongue stopped working. I nodded, even though I really didn't want to be around him. But we had unfinished business. On Saturday, I emerged from the subway and I saw Thomas Stone at a distance, standing outside the Mascarum in Greenwich Village. Though he'd been in America more than 20 years, he looked out of place. He had no interest in the menu displayed outside, and he did not notice the students pouring out from a New York University building, instrument cases in their hands, their hair, clothing, and multiple ear piercings setting them apart from other pedestrians. When he saw me, he was visibly relieved. Mascarum was small, with dark red curtains and walls that recalled the inside of a chicka hut. The aroma of coffee beans roasted over charcoal and the peppery smell of berbere made it feel a world away from Manhattan. We sat on rough-hewn three-legged wooden stools, low to the ground, with a woven basket table between us. A long mirror behind Thomas Stone allowed me to see both the back of his head and people entering or leaving the restaurant. The posters, thumbtacked to the walls, showed the castles of Gondar, a portrait of a smiling Tigray woman with strong, perfect teeth, a close-up of the wrinkled face of an Ethiopian priest, and an aerial view of Churchill Road, each with the same caption, 13 months of sunshine. Every Ethiopian restaurant I subsequently visited in America relied heavily on the same Ethiopian Airlines calendar for decor. The waitress, a short, bright-eyed Amhara, brought us menus. Her name was Anna. She almost dropped her pencil when I said in Amharic that I'd brought my own knife and I was so hungry that if she pointed me to where the cow was tethered, I'd get started. When she brought our food out on a circular tray, Thomas Stone looked surprised, as if he'd forgotten that we would eat with our fingers off a common plate. To his dismay, Anna, who hailed from the neighborhood of Kebina in Addis, not that far away from Missing, gave me gursha. She tore off a piece of injera, dipped it in curry, and fed me with her fingers. Thomas Stone hastily rose and asked for the restroom, lest she turn to him.
"Blessed Saint Gabriel," Anna said, watching him leave. "I scared your friend with our Habesha customs."
"He should know. He lived in Addis for 7 years."
"No, really?"
"Please, don't take offense."
"It's nothing," she said, smiling. "I know that type of Ferengi. Spend years there, but they look through us. But don't worry, you make up for it, and you're better looking."
I could have taken up for him. I could have said he was my father. I smiled. I'm sure I blushed. I said nothing. When Thomas Stone returned, he made a half-hearted effort to eat. Inevitably, one of the songs that cycled through the ceiling speakers was Tizita. I studied his face to see if it meant anything to him. It didn't. The mark of a native is that your fingers are never stained by the curry. You use the injera as your tongs, as a barrier, while you pick up a piece of chicken or beef sopped in the sauce. Thomas Stone's nails were red. Tillihoon singing Tizita, the cocoon-like atmosphere, and the frankincense brought memories bubbling to the surface. I thought of mornings at Missing, and how the mist had body and weight, as if it were a third element after earth and sky, but then it vanished when the sun was high. I remembered Rosina's songs, Gibru's chants, and Elmaza's magical teat. I recalled the sight of a younger Hema and Ghosh leaving for work as we waved through the kitchen window. I could see those halcyon days, shiny like a new coin, glinting in sunlight.
"Do you plan to finish your next 4 years of residency at Our Lady?" Thomas Stone said, abruptly, breaking into my reverie. "If you were interested in moving to Boston..."
So much for his perceptiveness. Just when I was ready to talk about the past, he wanted to know about my future. "I don't want to leave Our Lady. The hospital is my missing equivalent. I never wanted to leave Missing or Addis, but I had to. Now I don't want to leave Our Lady." Any other man would have asked me why I had to leave Missing. That was my fault. Had he posed the question, I might not have answered. And perhaps he knew that. As she cleared our plates, Anna said to Thomas Stone in English, "How did you like the food?"
"It was good," he said, barely glancing at her.
He reddened as she and I studied him.
"Thank you,"
he added, as if he hoped that would help get rid of her. She took two packaged towelettes out from her apron pocket and put them on the table. I said to Anna, "Honestly, it was good, but you could make the wort hotter."
"Of course we can," she said in Amharic,
a little taken aback by the implied criticism.
"But then people like him won't be able to touch the food. Also, we use local butter, so even if we make it hotter, it won't taste the same as home. Only someone like you would know the difference."
"You mean there is no place to get real Habesha food? The real thing? With all these Ethiopians in New York?" She shook her head.
"Not here. If you ever visit Boston, go see the Queen of Sheba. She's in Roxbury. She is famous. The house is like our embassy. Upstairs, in one room, they sell groceries, and downstairs they serve home food, cooked with true Ethiopian butter. The Ethiopian Airlines crew bring it just for her. All the Ethiopian taxi drivers eat there. You won't see anybody but Ethiopians there."
Thomas Stone had watched this exchange, his face blank. When Anna left, he reached into his pocket. I thought he was reaching for his billfold. Instead, he pulled out the bookmark I had left in his room, the one on which Sister Mary Joseph Praise had written her note to him. I dried my hands carefully and took it from him. I realized that I had missed it. It felt as if it shouldn't be here on a basket table, but in a bank vault. It had been my talisman on a harrowing journey, an escape from Ethiopia which he knew nothing about. I read her last lines. "Also, I am enclosing a letter to you from me. Please read at once. SMJP. And then I looked up. Thomas Stone fidgeted in his seat. He swallowed hard, leaning on the basket table.
"Marian, this bookmark was in the textbook, I presume?"
"Yes, it was. I have the textbook." He grew stiff, his hands trapped under his thighs as if an electric current were running through him.
"Would you... can I ask if... do you have...
was there a letter?" He looked helpless, sitting so low to the ground, like a parent visiting kindergarten, his knees under his chin. "I thought you had the letter," I said.
"No!"
he said so emphatically that Anna looked over at us.
"I'm sorry," I said, though I wasn't sure what I was sorry for. "I assumed that you took the letter when you left, that you left the book with the bookmark in it."
His face, so expectant a moment ago, collapsed.
"I took almost nothing," he said. "I walked out of Missing with the clothes I had on and one or two things from the office. I never went back."
"I know," I said. He cringed when I said those words. No wonder he was reluctant to probe my past. No blade can puncture the human heart like the well-chosen words of a spiteful son. But did he really think of me this way? As a son?
"But you took the finger with you," I went on. "Yes, that's all I took. It was in her room. I went back there."
He looked up. I said, "I'm sorry. I wish I had the letter."
"And the bookmark?" he said. "How did you get it?"
I sighed. Anna served us coffee. The small cup with no handle felt inadequate for my task of trying to cover a lifetime for this man. "I had to leave Ethiopia in haste. The authorities were looking for me. It's a long story. They thought I was involved in the hijacking of an Ethiopian Airlines plane. They thought I was a sympathizer for the Eritrean cause. Ridiculous, right? You remember your maid, Rosina? One of the hijackers was Rosina's daughter, Genet. Rosina is dead, by the way. Hanged herself." It was more than he could digest. "Rosina and Genet," I began. "Suffice it to say, I had an hour to get out of town. As I was leaving, climbing over Missing's wall, I said my goodbyes to Hema, Matron, Gibru, Almaz, and to Shiva, my brother." I stopped. I had hit a roadblock. "Shiva? Your other son?" Stone swallowed. This was proving impossible, and yet he needed to know, particularly if it was painful.
"My son,"
he said, trying out the word. "Your son. You want to see what he looks like?" He nodded, expecting me to pull out a wallet. "Look at the mirror behind you." He hesitated, as if this might be a joke, a trick. But he turned, and our eyes met in the mirror, startling me, because it was suddenly more intimate than I'd expected. Shiva and I are mirror images.
"What is he like?"
he asked without turning around. I sighed. I shook my head. I dropped my gaze. He turned back to me.
"Shiva is very different. A genius, I would say, but not in the usual way. Impatient with school. He'd never answer an exam question in a way that might make him pass, not because he didn't know. He has never understood the need to subscribe to convention. But he knows more medicine, certainly more gynecology, than I do. He works with Hema, doing fistula work. He's a brilliant surgeon. Trained, but by Hema. No medical school."
None of this would have been difficult for Stone to discover on his own had he been interested. He was interested now. "I was very close to Shiva when we were little boys." Stone's eyes were unblinking. I couldn't tell him the details of what had happened since. I had told no one. Only Genet and Shiva knew the truth. "He and Genet did something to hurt me that I cannot forgive."
"Something related to the hijacking?"
"No, no. That happened long before. Anyway, I was and still am very angry with him. But he is my brother, my twin, and so when I had 1 hour to leave the city, when the time came to say goodbye to Shiva, well, it was very painful for both of us." Suddenly, I found myself fighting for composure. It was terribly important for me not to cry in front of Thomas Stone. I pinched the inside of my thigh. As I was saying goodbye to Shiva, he handed me two books. One was his Grey's Anatomy. That was his most valued possession. He dragged it around like a blanket. And the second was your book, with that bookmark inside. I didn't know how he got it, or how long he had it. I didn't even know you had written a book. The book was hardly opened. I don't think Shiva ever read it, certainly not like he devoured his Greys. He probably saw and read the bookmark. But you have to know Shiva. He wouldn't be curious about the bookmark or the letter she referred to. Shiva lives in the now. I don't know just how he got the book or why he wanted to give it to me. Stone remained silent, his gaze on the empty basket between us, as if it stood in for all that was unknown about his past. Our past. His look of pain was so intense it pierced me. I can ask him, I offered. I wanted to know just as much as Thomas Stone did. I will ask him, I said. Thomas Stone was a world away. When he lifted his gaze, I understood the depths of his sorrow. I saw it in a darkening of his iris, even though the delicate structure should not change color. I could see that the almost mystical aura of this legendary surgeon, the single-mindedness, the dedication, the skill, was mere surface. The surgical persona was something he had crafted to protect himself. But what he had created was a prison. Any time he strayed from the professional to the personal, he knew what to expect. Pain. When he spoke, his voice sounded tired, old.
And here I thought you had it, and you thought I...
What do you think is in the letter?
How I wish I knew, he said abruptly. I'd give my right arm.
It had been a few months since I met Thomas Stone. The anger I felt obliged to have had subsided. The story he told me of his childhood, his mother's death, should have been enough to forgive him, but I didn't think I was ready for that. I hadn't forgiven Shiva, so why forgive Thomas Stone? Even if I had forgiven him, a perverse streak in me refused to let him know that. But I had unfinished business with him. There's something I have to tell you, I said. I never thought I would be ashamed in front of this man. Something I was charged to tell you by Ghosh. Ghosh's wish had seemed irrational to me at the time. But now, looking into that hard, craggy face, I understood why Ghosh had wanted me to reach out to Stone. Ghosh knew Thomas, but Ghosh had overestimated my maturity. Ghosh had a dying wish which I promised to fulfill, but I didn't. I ignored it. I hope you and he will forgive me. Ghosh told me that he felt his life would be incomplete without my doing this. His wish was for me to come and find you, to let you know that he considered you a brother. This was hard, both because I could recall Ghosh's labored breathing, could recall Ghosh's every word, and because I was now seeing the effect those words had on Thomas Stone. Other than his mother and Dr. Ross in the sanatorium, who had ever expressed love for him? Sister Mary Joseph Praise, perhaps, but did she ever get to tell him? And if she did he hear? Ghosh was disappointed that you never contacted him, but he wanted you to know that whatever your reason was for being silent all those years, it was all right with him. Ghosh had felt it was shame that kept Thomas from looking back. He was right, because it was shame that colored his face now.
I'm so sorry, Stone said.
I don't know whether he was speaking to me, or Ghosh, or the universe. It wasn't enough, but it was about time. If there were other people in the restaurant, I was no longer aware of them. If there was music playing, I couldn't hear it. I studied my father as I might study some specimen set before me. I saw the smile that struggled for purchase on his face and failed. And then I saw the haunted and hunted look that came in its wake. God help us if such a man had tried to raise us, if he had taken us away from Ethiopia. With all the sorrow and loss I'd experienced, I'd never have traded my past at missing for a life in Boston with him. I should have thanked Thomas Stone for leaving Ethiopia. The love he felt for Sister Mary Joseph Praise had come too late. She was the mystery, the great regret that he would take to his grave, and he would regret nothing more than not knowing what she said in that letter. "I'll write to Shiva," I said. "I'll ask about the letter." I suppose I understood Thomas Stone shutting people out. After Gennett's betrayal, I never wanted to have such strong feelings for a woman again. Not unless I had a written guarantee. I'd encountered a medical student from Mecca, a saint compared with my first love. She was kind, generous, beautiful, and seemed to transcend herself, as if her existence was secondary to her interest in the world and the things in it, including me. My belated and muted response must have pushed her away, lost me any chance of a future with her. Did I feel sad? Yes. And stupid? Yes. But I also felt relieved. By losing her, I was protected from her, and she from me. I had that in common with this man sitting before me. I thought of a watch that had stopped ticking, and how it showed the correct time twice a day. He paid. I rose with him. At the door of the restaurant, our hands in our pockets, I waited.
"Call no man happy until he dies," he said.
Before I could tell if that was a smile or an expression of sadness on his face, he nodded and walked away. Chapter 48. Five Fingers. Just after midnight on the first Sunday of every month, I would ring Hema at her bungalow. It was 7 o'clock, Monday morning, Addis time. The rates were best at this hour, but since Almaz, Gibru, and sometimes Matron came on before Hema, it could still be a long and expensive call. Ever since Hema delivered Comrade Mengistu's child, we no longer worried about the secret police eavesdropping on us. Besides, they were preoccupied with real enemies. Mengistu Haile Mariam, Strength of Mary, Secretary General of the Council of Peasants and Workers, Chairman of the Military Council of Socialist Ethiopia, President for Life of the Armed Forces of the Democratic Peoples of Ethiopia, General in Command of the Bureau for Armed Struggle Against Imperial Aggression in Tigray and Eritrea, had adopted an Albanian style of Marxism. The upper and middle classes and even the working poor had their houses confiscated and land taken away. But favors to Mengistu, and particularly favors to his wife, weren't forgotten. Missing's medicines and supplies were not held up in the customs go-down, and there were no palms to grease. As I dialed Hema's number that Sunday, I pictured my missing family watching the clock, coffee cups in their hands, waiting for the phone to ring from a continent none of them had seen. Almaz picked up the receiver, with Gibru leaning in, both of them suddenly shy and self-conscious. Their side of the conversation consisted of repeated, "Endemene? Denane woy? How are you? Are you well then?" Until these godparents of mine were satisfied that their liege, their child, was all right. They told me they kept me in their prayers, fasted for me. "Pray that I'll see you soon, and may God take care of you and your health," I said. Matron was just the opposite, chatty and spontaneous, as if we had run into each other in the corridor outside her office. I had reported to Hema my first sighting of Thomas Stone. She'd listened without comment, and she must have smiled when she heard of her son breaking and entering Thomas Stone's apartment. I didn't censor information for her benefit. Surely Thomas Stone was no longer the threat he'd once been to her when we were minors. When I had told her about placing the bookmark on Stone's desk as my calling card, I read from Hema's silence that she'd known nothing about Shiva's having the expedient operator a short practice of tropical surgery. I surmised from that, and later confirmed from Matron, that Hema had made every attempt to banish the book from missing. She'd never wanted me or Shiva to see his work, much less a picture of him. "I had dinner with Thomas Stone, Ma," I said, when she came on the line. "I ate in Jera for the first time in well over a year." She was miffed to learn that Ghosh had a message for Stone. I read that in the fact that she said nothing. When I told her just what Ghosh had wanted me to say to Stone, I heard a vigorous honk on her kerchief. The message said more about Ghosh and his selflessness than it did about Thomas Stone. I asked if she knew about the bookmark or a letter that accompanied it. She didn't. "Maybe Shiva knows," I said. "Can I speak to him?" She called out his name, a summons I had heard so many times since I was a child. I heard Shiva's reply and could judge from its echo that it had come from our childhood room. While I waited, I heard Hema asking Matron about the bookmark. Her "no" told me it was news to her. The telephone was never a comfortable instrument in Shiva's hands. He was fine, the fistula work was going very well, and no, he knew nothing about any missing letter. "Do you remember the bookmark, Shiva, and the reference to a letter?" I asked. "Yes." "But you're saying there was no letter in the book?" "No letter." "How did you get the book, Shiva?" "Ghosh gave it to me."
"When?"
"When he was dying. He wanted to talk with me about many things. This was one. He said he'd taken the book from Thomas Stone's quarters on the day we were born. He had kept it. He wanted me to have it." "Was that the first time you'd seen the textbook or seen a picture of Thomas Stone?"
"Yes."
"Did Ghosh mention a letter from Sister Mary, our mother, to Stone?"
"No, he didn't."
"Did he say why he wanted you to have the book?"
"No."
"When you saw the bookmark and the reference to the letter, did you go back and ask him?"
"No."
I sighed. I could have stopped there, but I had come this far.
"Why not?"
I asked. "If he wanted me to have the letter, he would have given it to me." "Why did you give me the book, Shiva?"
"I wanted you to have it."
There was no annoyance in Shiva's voice. His tone was no different than when we began. I wondered if he'd picked up the irritation in mine. Shiva was right. There either was no letter, or Ghosh had the letter and had his reasons for destroying it. I was about to say goodbye. I knew better than to expect my brother to ask about my health or my welfare. But he took me aback by saying, "How are your operating theaters?" He wanted to know about the layout, how far away the autoclave and the locker rooms were, and was there a sink outside each room or one common scrubbing area. I gave him a detailed picture. When I was done, I waited. Once again, he surprised me. "When are you coming home, Marion?"
"Well, Shiva, I have 4 more years of residency."
Was this his way of saying he was sorry for everything that had happened? That he missed me? Did I want that from him? I wasn't sure, so all I added was, "I don't know if it is safe for me to come, but if it is, I'd love to come a year or so from now. Why don't you come visit here?"
"Will I be able to see your operating theaters?"
"Sure. We call them operating rooms here, not theaters, but I can arrange for you to see them."
"Okay, I'll be there."
Hema came back on the line. She was in a chatty mood, reluctant to let me go. Listening to her lilting voice, I was transported back to missing meantime, as if I was sitting by the phone under Nehru's photograph and looking across the room at the portrait of Ghosh, which consecrated the spot where he spent so many hours listening to the Grundig. When I hung up, I felt despair. I was back in the Bronx, my walls bare but for the framed ecstasy of St. Teresa. My beeper, silent till then, went off. and answering its summons, I slipped the yoke back around my neck. Indeed, I welcomed my slavish existence as a surgical resident, the never-ending work, the crises that kept me in the present, the immersion in blood, pus, and tears, the fluids in which one dissolved all traces of self. In working myself ragged, I felt integrated. I felt American. And I rarely had time to think of home. Then, in 4 weeks, it was time to dial missing again. Were these phone calls just as difficult for Hema? I wondered. In a letter after our call, Hema said that she'd checked with Pacelli, Almaz, and even WW Gonad to see if they had heard of Ghosh or Sister leaving a letter behind, but no one had. She told me that Shiva's application for an exit visa to come visit me was held up by the government. He was asked to provide affidavits to show he had no debts in Ethiopia, and moreover that I had no debts for which he might be responsible. She said she would remind Shiva to work on the visa. Reading between the lines, I knew and she knew that Shiva had lost interest. I wrote to Thomas Stone to let him know that the whereabouts of Sister Mary Joseph Praise's letter remained a mystery. He never wrote back to me, thanking me for my troubles. Over the next 4 years, I saw Thomas Stone now and then when he came to conduct conferences or bedside teaching rounds. He was impressive, as I knew he would be, masterful, serious, and in command of his subject. He had the kind of perspective that could only come from careful study of the literature of surgery and from living it for many years. I much preferred being around him in that fashion than having a dinner with him. Perhaps he felt the same way because he didn't call or visit again. I went up to Boston for 3 separate month-long rotations, plastic surgery, urology, and transplant, and the work was engrossing, challenging, so that each time my anxieties about being there and near him were forgotten. I worked with him in that last rotation, which was busier than I'd ever imagined. He suggested once during that time that we have a meal, but I begged off because my work in the transplant intensive care unit simply did not allow me to get away before 9 in the evening, even on my nights off. I think he was relieved. By 1986, I had finished my year as chief resident, which was also my 5th year of training, and I stayed on as an assistant to Deepak as I prepared to take my board exam. Grudgingly, I had come to admire the long, arduous American system of surgical training. It was easier to admire when you were about done with it. I felt technically competent to do all the major operations of general surgery, and I knew my limits. There wasn't much I hadn't seen at Our Lady. More important, I was confident about caring for patients before and after surgery and in the intensive care settings. Also in 1986, my brother became famous. It was Deepak who showed me the feature article in the New York Times. What a shock it was to see Shiva's picture, to see in it my reflection, but with shorter hair, almost a crew cut, and without the grey that had completely taken over my sideburns and temples. The image brought immediate bitterness, the recollection of the pain of betrayal. And yes, envy. Shiva had taken the first and only girl I loved and spoiled her for me. Now he was making headlines in my backyard, in my newspaper. I'd followed all the rules and tried to do the right thing while he ignored all the rules. And here we were. Could an equitable God have allowed such a thing? I confess, it was a while before I could read the article. According to the Times, Shiva was the world's expert and the leading advocate for women with vaginal fistula. He was the genius behind a WHO fistula prevention campaign that was a far cry from the usual Western approach to these issues. The Times reproduced the colorful 5 failings that lead to fistula poster. It showed a hand, the fingers splayed out. Peering at the photograph, I could see that it was Shiva's hand. In the palm was a seated woman in a posture of dejection. Was the model the staff probationer? The poster was distributed all over Africa and Asia and printed in 40 languages. village midwives were taught to count off on one hand the 5 failings. The first was being married off too young, child brides. The second was non-existent prenatal care. The third was waiting too long to admit that labor had stalled, by which time the baby's head was jammed halfway down the birth passage and doing its damage, and a cesarean section was needed. The fourth failing was too few and too distant health centers where a C-section could be done. Presuming the mother lived, the baby never did. The final failing was that of the husband and in-laws who cast out the woman because of the dribbling odoriferous fistula from bladder to vagina, or from rectum to vagina, or both. Suicide was a common ending to such a story. Somehow women with fistula find their way to Shiva Pray Stone, the article said. They come by bus as far as they can before the other passengers kick them off. They come on foot or by donkey. They come often with a piece of paper in their hand that simply says in Amharic, missing, or fistula hospital, or cutting for stone. Shiva Stone was not a physician, but a skilled layperson initiated into this field by his gynecologist mother. When I next spoke to Hema, I asked her to congratulate Shiva for me. Ma, I said, you should have gotten more recognition in that story. Without you, Shiva couldn't be doing what he does.
No, Marian, this is really all his doing. Fistula surgery wasn't something I relished. It suits someone as single-minded as Shiva. It needs constant attention, before, during, and after surgery. You should see the hours he spends thinking over each case, anticipating every problem. He can see the fistula in 3 dimensions.
Shiva had fashioned new instruments in his workshop and invented new techniques. The article had mentioned Matron's fundraising efforts and the desperate needs, and the article brought donations pouring in. Matron had in mind a new missing building devoted to women with fistula.
Shiva has had the plans drawn out for years. It will be in the shape of a V with wings converging on operating Theatre 3.
Theatre 3 was to be overhauled and remodeled, making 2 operating rooms with a shared scrub area in the middle. I reread the Times article late that night. I felt a hollow sensation in my belly this time as I went through it again. The writer's unabashed admiration for Shiva came through, and one sensed she had abandoned her reserve, her usual dispassionate tone, because the man, more than the subject, so moved her. She ended with a quote from my brother. "What I do is simple. I repair holes," said Shiva Praise Stone. "Yes, but you make them too, Shiva." I had my own success, albeit a quieter one. I passed the written exam of the American Board of Surgery. A few months after that, I was assigned to take my oral exams in Boston at the Copley Plaza Hotel. After a grueling hour and a half in front of 2 examiners, I was done. I knew I did well. Outside, the day was glorious. The monolith of gray stone that was the Church of Christian Scientists stood serene at the end of a long reflecting pool and framed against a blue sky. For 5 years, I had spent my nights and days in the hospital, not seeing the sky, not feeling the sun on my face. I felt the urge to wade through the water fully clothed, or to let out a victory whoop. I contented myself instead with an ice cream cone, which I enjoyed while sitting by the reflecting pool. I planned to head to the airport, take the shuttle back to New York. But seeing that my driver was so obviously Ethiopian, and having greeted him in our language, I had another idea. Yes, of course he knew the Queen of Sheba's in Roxbury, and it would be an honor for him to take me there. "My name is Mesfin," he said, grinning at me in the rearview mirror. "Who are you? What do you do?" "My name is Stone," I said, putting my seatbelt on, although I wasn't worried. Nothing bad could happen to me on this day. "I'm a surgeon." Chapter 49. Queen's Move. The street had a junkyard at the corner, with high walls and barbed wire so reminiscent of Kachele prison. A massive dog, chained and asleep, was visible through the gate. Then came a string of vacant lots where ashes and soot outlined whatever had stood there. Mesfin seemed to be pointing the cab to the sole house at the end of the street that survived the blight that had felled the others. Its driveway began in the middle of the road, as if the paving machine had run out of asphalt when it got this far, and so the owner took things into her own hands. The split-level house had yellow shingles. The steps, the railings, the pillars, the doors, the decks, and even the drains were painted the same canary yellow. A column of unpainted wheel hubs showed up a corner of the sagging front veranda. There were four taxis parked outside, all yellow. The smell of fermenting honey elicited a Pavlovian response from my taste buds. A Dua Somali met us at the door and led us to a dining room 6 steps down from the front landing. We found a half dozen men eating at the picnic tables and benches, with room for a dozen more. The wooden floor was strewn with freshly cut grass, just as it would have been if this were a home or restaurant in Addis. We washed our hands and took our seats, and at once a buxom woman arrived, bowing, wishing us good health, and placing water and 2 small flasks of golden yellow tej before us. The cornea of her left eye was milky white. Mesfin said her name was Taitu. Behind her, a younger woman brought a tray of injera on which were generous servings of lamb, lentils, and chicken.
"You see,"
Mesfin said, looking at his watch,
"I can eat here quicker than I can pump gas in my car. It's cheaper, too."
I ate as if I had lived through a famine. The waitress in New York who first told me about the Queen of Sheba's had been right. This was the real thing. Through a side window that looked out into a sloping yard, I saw a white Corvette slide up. A shapely leg in heels emerged, the skin a café au lait color, with a shade of nail polish that B.C. Gandhi called fuck me red. A baby goat appeared from nowhere and danced around those elegant feet. Soon a lovely Ethiopian lady came cautiously down the stairs, careful not to snag her heels. She said over her shoulder to the Somali,
"Why is that silly boy letting the baby goat out at this hour? One of these days I'll run over it."
Her golden brown hair had red streaks, and it was cut in a perky, asymmetrical style that revealed her neck. She wore a maroon pinstriped blazer over a white blouse and skirt. The Queen, for there was little doubt that this was she, bowed in our direction while continuing on to an office next to the kitchen. She stopped abruptly. She turned as if she had seen a vision, and she stared. I was in my suit, my tie loosened. Did I look that out of place? Within the confines of Our Lady of Perpetual Succor, all the tribes of Abraham were represented, and I felt no more foreign than my patients or the staff. Now, as I attracted her attention and that of the others there, I felt like a Ferengi again.
"Praise God, praise his son,"
the Queen said, her hands on her cheeks. She shifted her tinted glasses to her forehead, revealing eyes that were wide open in astonishment. I looked behind me. Could she be talking to someone else? Her expression, at first quizzical, now turned joyous, showing brilliant white and perfect teeth.
"Child, do you not know me?"
she said, coming close, her rose-scented attar preceding her. I came to my feet, still puzzled.
"I pray for you every day," she said in Amharic. "Don't tell me that I have changed that much."
I towered over her. I was tongue-tied. She had been a mother and I a boy when I first met her. "Sige?" I said at last. She lunged toward me, kissed my cheeks, held me at arm's length to better examine me, then pulled me to her to bump cheeks again and again.
"My God, Blessed Mary and all the saints, how are you? Is it you? Endemene, denanewoy, how are you? Can this be you? Praise God that you are here."
After 6 years in America, it was only at that moment, standing in that yellow house, in her arms, cut grass under my feet, that I felt at ease in this land, felt my guard come down and the muscles in my belly and neck relax. Here was someone from my past, from my very street, someone whom I liked and with whom I had always felt a bond. I kissed her cheeks as vigorously as she kissed mine,